Intercom is the business messaging platform that does the manual work for you, automatically qualifying leads and scheduling demos. Their chatbot and messenger free you up to focus on the prospects most likely to convert. You can leave your pipeline to chance, or you can use Intercom. Start for free at intercom.com/growth. That's intercom.com/growth. David, on April 20th, every media organization in America did a story on athletes and weed. Get it? 420?
Yes.
Weed? What I want to know is, what other dates on the calendar would you like to see become a fake peg for feature stories?
This is easy for me.
Okay.
March 16th, Stone Cold Steve Austin Day.
Mm.
Austin 316.
I got it. Yeah.
Austin 316 says, I just commissioned a feature story.
What about an oral history of all news New York radio stations that runs on October 10th? Is 10-10 wins like a, is that a universal
Everybody
thing?
Gets a 10-10 wins punchline. Aren't we in the post 420 world at this point? If we're at a point where professional athletes are smoking weed on camera for sports media outlets, aren't we past the point where we need to peg this onto national elbow in the ribs, tee-hee, weed smoking day?
Yeah, is it just that journalism is essentially dad humor at a high level, and so they're just catching up on the joke?
I think that's part of it.
Look what we're getting away with.
I think that it's the tyranny of pegs. You know, it's like if you have faith in your investigation into athletes and weed, it doesn't need to be published on 420.
Yeah, I'd just like to see more things shoehorned into the blank and weed template.
Okay, go.
North Korean diplomacy and weed. A Quiet Place and weed.
Yeah, athletes and weed seems a little bit too restrictive at this point.
You're listening to The Press Box, a disappointingly sober part of the Ringer Podcast Network. The Press Box is the media podcast. We are not allowed to assemble a 7-round mock draft. Hat tip Roger Sherman on that one. We are Brian Curtis and David Shoemaker of The Ringer. I felt last week was an incredibly good week for substantial big Ringer stories.
Yes.
Did you, David? Really enjoyed Lindsay Zolad's on the Me Too rehab and Allison Herman on Amy Schumer. And if you insist on finding our stuff, you can read me on the Denver Post's Endangered Sports section and David in audio form on Westworld in our new pod, Westworld. The Recapables.
Thank you.
David, three topics for you today for this podcast. First, we talk about Trump's fixation, or is it reliance, on New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman. Second, sideline reporter Ali LaForce asks LeBron James a real question, and everyone loses their ever-loving minds. Were they right to? And finally, three inevitable things about American life: death, taxes, and Harper's Magazine firing its editor. What is the place in the journalistic culture for a monthly like Harper's today? Plus, as always, our overworked Twitter joke of the week. But first, a topic I like to call Wake Up Maggie. I think I got something to tweet to you.
Literally the same joke I was just about to make.
I knew you would. We both settled on the same horrible headline. David, the nation's political class paused this weekend for the funeral of Barbara Bush. But Donald Trump, as he often does, tweeted through it. And here are the tweets that caught my eye. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times and a third-rate reporter named Maggie Haberman, known as a crooked H flunky, who I don't speak to and have nothing to do with, remember that line, please, are going out of their way to destroy Michael Cohen, that would be Trump's lawyer, and his relationship with me in hopes that he will, quote, flip. They use non-existent, quote, sources and a drunk, drugged-up loser who hates Michael. A fine person with a wonderful family. Michael is a businessman on it for his own account. Lawyer, who I have always liked and respected. Most people will flip if the government, that is with a capital G, David, lets them out of trouble, even if it means lying or making up stories. Sorry, I don't see Michael doing that, despite the horrible witch hunt and dishonest media. A couple notes about these tweets, by the way. Maggie Haberman's name was initially spelled with two B's before Trump corrected himself. Also, he appeared to confuse Democratic National Committee Chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz with Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Wendy Wasserstein. Died in 2006, according to the Washington Post. Did not know Trump was a fan of the Heidi Chronicles. Also, a Tom's photographer, this is also per the Washington Post, Tom Benner, saw Trump looking at his phone in South Florida today. There was like a photo of Trump in a motorcade, like looking at his phone.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if he's looking at his mentions or actually composing these tweets. Anyway, the subject of Trump's ire was a Friday, April 20th story in which Haberman and Sharon Lafreniere and Danny Hakim reported about Trump's potentially deteriorating relationship with Michael Cohen. What did you make of this whole Trump Twitter binge, tweet storm, etc.?
Yeah, putting me on the spot, as always. I don't know, man. In some ways, this was we talked last week about how we were kind of seeing a Trump that's sort of like a parallel universe Trump in certain ways. I think this is sort of the opposite end of the spectrum. This is the pure distillation. It's like, as you said, while all living past presidents are at Barbara Bush's funeral, Donald Trump is just like in the bunker, just, you know, typing in the tweet version of nuclear codes. I mean, he's just going absolutely, absolutely haywire.
Yeah. Was he just mad that he wasn't there? That Melania was there and he wasn't? I'm not saying like he wanted to go.
No.
That creates a strange insecurity in him.
I think a lot of people have read that back into it. I don't know that he was seeing live photos from there or anything, so I'm not sure how much that would have mattered.
But knowing that like the Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama,
yeah,
Melania, George W. Bush, I mean, these are people that he all has an extremely complicated relationship with, to mm-hmm. say the least, are all at this funeral.
Sure.
All of whom he has inveighed against except Melania publicly. And he is perhaps, insulted her in different ways.
Yeah, now that she laughed at an Obama joke at the
right,
we'll see what kind of response she gets on Twitter now.
Here's a subject I have talked about to bring it back to Maggie Haberman for a second, which is the interesting specific media story here, right? I've bandied about with people online is why does Trump talk to Maggie Haberman?
Yeah.
Right? He insisted in the tweet that he didn't. But Michael Schmidt, New York Times reporter, posted a photo of Trump and Haberman in the Oval Office together.
Mm-hmm.
And here's some sound from Trump's interview with Haberman and other Times reporters last July.
Sessions gets the job. Right after he gets the job, he recuses himself.
Was that a mistake?
Well, Sessions should have never recused himself. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me before he took the job and I would have picked somebody else.
Mm-hmm. He gave you no heads up at all in any sense.
Zero.
Why do you think he continues to talk to her despite the fact that she has broken, surely, more devastating stories about Trump and the Trump White House than anybody?
I think that there's some appeal of being a part of living history, that it's kind of hard for you or I or anyone else who's not a president or someone of that stature to wrap one's mind around, right? People roll out the red carpet for Woodward to come in and write these books that end up being like 50-50 praise and
just
total takedowns, right?
Yep.
Because it's sort of the thing that you do. And I think that certainly for Trump, I mean, without, you know, over-analyzing him, you know, he grew up in New York. The New York Times is, you know, the newspaper of record, and to have, you know, their top reporter there asking you, imploring you to talk about yourself, there's a lot of flattery built into that.
Writing about you every day.
Yeah.
Which even he couldn't get from Page Six and the gossip column, the Daily News.
Sure.
Right?
And the way that we've heard, you know, that's been reported that he takes in media or that media is kind of presented to him. It's a lot about the pull quotes or a lot about the, you know, the part that's underlined either literally or figuratively. And, you know, I think it's totally feasible that he's had a very high opinion of her on any given day. The more interesting question is why. Yeah, you're right. Why does he continue to talk to her if this is how he really feels? And I mean, I guess the question is whether he really has changed his opinion of Maggie Haberman or is not sure that is confusing her with someone else. It's very strange.
Yeah, I would guess from the outside that his opinion of Maggie Haberman can't have gotten better as
sure,
she's broken
sure.
story after story. And we should say that the particular one in this case that made him angry was this Friday, April 20th story, which included a couple of things like she and her co-writers write, Mr. Trump has treated Mr. Cohen poorly with gratuitous insults, dismissive statements, and at least twice threats of being fired. And somebody got the quote from Roger Stone, Donald goes out of his way to treat him like garbage. I think there's a couple of things. One, another theory is essentially that she's just so good at her job that you have to talk to her, right?
Yeah.
That Trump sees some kind of benefit or, you know, requirement.
I would believe that with just about anyone else except for Donald Trump. But yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's definitely some truth there.
Also just that he just likes the attention, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Not only
in the moment, for sure.
Yeah. Right. Like somebody's calling and he can get on the phone and talk. He likes to talk.
And you're right. He comes from the as sensitive as he's made out, he's portrayed to be at times. He definitely comes from the no publicity or all publicity is good publicity school, right?
Okay, he is the headmaster of that school.
Yeah,
he is the dean.
And I think it's
provost.
Probably easier for him to read some of her other pieces and sort of dismiss it all as publicity. But when the piece is about Cohen, and the piece has his has other friends and confidants anonymously or on the record, sort of notching points against him as well. I mean, God, Roger Stone, who would have thought that he would have, I mean, I guess anyone would have thought he would have gone on the record there, but on this, for this story, you know, that's got to hit him where it hurts. And I think that it's, you know, it's probably a cumulative effect.
Yeah. I think that's, it's interesting. It's interesting because Trump gets so much negative publicity from the major news outlets in the United States that it's interesting when something sets him off.
Yeah.
Like, what is the ingredient that you really do? In this case, Haberman herself has written that he finds the New York part of this investigation much more, he and his advisors, much more threatening.
Sure, we've been seeing elements of that from the very beginning.
Right, than the Mueller investigation. Here's Haberman responding on CNN to what she thought was the nature of Trump's relationship with Michael Cohen.
The president has destroyed their relationship pretty handily on his own over a very long period of time, and that is what the story was about, which is that he has been... he is abusive, according to almost everyone I speak to most people in his orbit, and family is not accepted from that. But he is particularly abusive to Cohen over the years. And then the question becomes, does that come back to haunt him?
But essentially, I think the takeaway from that, David, is that like the Trump gets defensive when it's really getting close, right? You know, it's getting close to the mark. You know, something about him trying to fire, you know, wondering out loud whether he should fire Mueller, right? Or reporting about him insulting Jeff Sessions, right? That's not that threatening, right? At the end of the day, Trump probably likes that that's out in the world. He probably likes to know that Mueller and Sessions are reading those kind of stories. But when it's something like this where it's like, uh-oh, she's making a really good case that Michael Cohen could could flip, to use his word, on me, then I think he just gets a little, you know, got to go to Twitter.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was Jonathan Chait last week who made, I thought, a really salient point about all this, is that with all the talk about flipping and you know, people giving up the goods on Donald Trump and whatever turn of phrase, you know, from the, you know, from the olden days that you want to use, it really seems like somebody should be out there saying, like, it doesn't matter what Michael Cohen does because Trump hasn't done anything wrong. One would think that that would be the conversation that the president, at least the office of the White House, was steering the narrative in that direction. But instead, Trump's just sort of going in with this, like, flipping thing. And I know he made the point that anyone would flip given the pressure. And I guess you can read into that anyone would what he would say is that anyone would lie under oath for the sake of not going to jail.
For a long time, yeah.
But the entire narrative has now turned into...
Will Mueller
find out what Trump did wrong, and not did Trump do something wrong?
Yeah, it's not I'm innocent. It's like, don't worry, he won't flip on me.
Yeah,
he knows what he knows how to handle. He knows how to play this.
Alan Dershowitz was on TV last week or over the weekend saying, if you dig into anybody with a portfolio as big as Trump's, you can find things. You can send him to jail for something.
Right.
You know, it's just like everybody's
not he's innocent.
Yeah, it's a really bizarre like series of like this tapestry of excuses.
This was a small part of a very bonkers Twitter weekend for Trump. Should we go over some highlights?
Can we talk about Sylvester Stallone? Are you going to get?
Let's start there. Sylvester Stallone called me with the story of heavyweight boxing champion Jack Johnson. His trials and tribulations were great. His life complex and controversial. I am considering a full pardon.
Yes, let's pardon Jack Johnson. This is something I can align myself with Trump on for sure.
But just the whole.
But what a weird tweet of all the tweets.
Okay, beyond the Jack Johnson bit.
Yeah, Sylvester Stallone called me.
I loved, there was an amazing line in the Times. I mean, just like we could just isolate literally every line in the Times, right? But this one was particularly funny to me. The White House did not immediately respond to a question about the frequency with which Mr. Trump and Mr. Stallone communicate. Could be daily. Could be hourly. There was also this tweet about Mr. Peepers.
Oh, my gosh.
Where he was using the air quotes.
Yeah. So the exact quote is, the Washington Post said, I refer to Jeff Sessions as, quote, Mr. Magoo, and Rod Rosenstein as, quote, Mr. Peepers. This is, quote, according to people with whom the president has spoken, end quote. There are no such people and don't know these characters. just more fake and disgusting news to create ill will.
Okay.
Wait, so I'm confused. Is he saying that Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein don't exist when he says there are no such people?
Also, are you as mesmerized by Trump's use of air quotes as I am?
Yes.
Mr. Peepers.
Yeah. I'm actually very impressed by his tweeting style in general.
A couple of people pointed out that there are very few people in the press corps under the age of 40 who know who that is.
Like Mr. Peepers?
Yeah, or Mr. Magoo. Sure. Even. They may have heard Mr. Magoo.
Oh, under 40. Yeah.
Did I say under 40? May have used, they would have any idea who Mr. Magoo was?
No. Mr. Magoo
was
old, like,
for us.
Yeah, you're aware that it's like derisive, but that's about it.
Another tweet from the weekend, Sleepy Eyes Chuck Todd. Definitely the weirdest of his insults. Fake News NBC, Slippery Comey maybe number two, but Fake News NBC just stated that we have given up so much in our negotiations with North Korea and they have given up nothing. Wow. We haven't even given up anything. Ampersand, they have agreed to denuclearization. So great for world. World is capitalized. Site closure and no more testing! Exclamation point.
I love the wow as the sort of acerbic response to the first part. That definitely feels like a dad text or something, you know? And it's just like one of your parents is upset about like a sports take and is forwarding that onto you.
Yeah,
you know?
Wow, comma is kind of an amazing way to start a sentence, especially for a world leader. There's also a tweet this weekend that just said, a complete witch hunt, exclamation point.
I missed that one. I guess that got lost in the haze.
I don't know. I'm sure it meant he doesn't link his tweets, right? So sometimes it's his like kicker.
Sure.
But you don't, if you're not there at the moment, you don't quite understand what it was to.
It's true. Do you see the minor kerfluffle about him referring to Mar-a-Lago as the Southern White House?
Yes.
And that's an apparent ethics violation because you should not be able to buy your way into any remote White House. Remember when things like Mar-a-Lago and Twitter, and you mentioned the photo earlier of like the idea that he wouldn't give up his iPhone. You remember when those were the controversies that momentarily obsessed us?
Yes. That seems like a very, very long time ago.
I'm not sure if that means that like all of that was meaningless and we should not care about such things in the future, or if it just means that, you know, it's hard to remember the rain after the monsoon has hit.
I think it's pretty much the latter. Yeah. One more chapter to this, which was the photo of all of our living presidents and first ladies standing together at Barbara Bush's funeral, George H.W. Bush. I think photos like that are interesting. I also think we can over-romanticize that there was this world before Trump when everything was fine, right? And everything was cordial and all the politicians were nice, right? Mm-hmm. I just want to say there is something. I am not immune to, you know, having my heart warmed by seeing a photo like that. And Trump is certainly an outlier in media terms and presidential terms and everything terms, right?
Sure.
But everybody in that photo had their rough edges. And everybody, you know, a lot of the people in that photo ran really nasty campaigns back in the day. Mm-hmm. This is reminded me of that. Remember when that letter that George Bush wrote to Bill Clinton upon losing the presidency and handing it over to Clinton was going around on Twitter like crazy in 2016. Like, look at the guy who used to have this office. Let's just not over-romanticize old politicians. Let's not let Trump turn everyone who came before him into a saint in every part of their lives because of his behavior and his tweets and everything else.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say on that.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
All right, David, now it's time for our overworked Twitter joke of the week, where we celebrate a gag that was so obvious that all of media Twitter made it at exactly the same time. Should we just get Stormy Daniels' sketch out of the way first?
Yeah. I mean, that's the best one.
Yeah. Last Tuesday, Daniels and her lawyer, Michael Avenatti, released an artist rendering of a man who allegedly threatened Daniels in Las Vegas after she negotiated to sell her Trump affair story to a magazine. He was kind of the perp. It's kind of a long-haired, vaguely handsome-looking guy with a 5 o'clock shadow.
Nice jawline, yeah.
Nice jawline, right. If you read media Twitter, you saw people ID the assailant as noted actor Klaus Kinski, Mark McGrath, the puppet Gary Johnston from Team America World Police.
Yes.
Johnny Damon, that's from our producer Jim Cunningham. Good job, Jim.
Yeah.
And most commonly, the famously bad Tom Brady courtroom sketch, I think. Thanks to Jack Sinclair and Kyle Madsen for that one.
I think that every week there should be an unofficial caption contest on Twitter. This fit the bill this week.
Yeah, this was like the world's unofficial caption contest.
The world sees a photo and everybody makes a joke simultaneously.
David, did you see that Shania Twain is back in the news?
I did.
Asked by The Guardian about Donald Trump, America's favorite 90s pseudo-country crooner said, quote, "I would have voted for him because even though he was offensive, he seemed honest. I would have voted for a feeling that it was transparent, and politics has a reputation for being not that, right?" It was the lowest of low-hanging fruit to tweet, "That don't impress me much." By people who might have felt warmly about Shania Twain before, but now are mad that Shania Twain showed some Trump curiosity.
Yeah. I just think, yeah, any Shania Twain lyric tweet is a winner in my book.
That's from Daniel T. Clark and Colton Saylor. Also, by the way, I enjoy the Shania apology afterwards. Quote, "As a Canadian, I regret answering this unexpected question without giving my response more context." I want to start every sentence of my life with, "As a Canadian, comma." Matthew Zeitlin, who this week gets promoted to permanent guest host of the Press Box for his numerous contributions to this podcast, sends another good one. David, did you happen to see the new American panic over lettuce?
Oh, yeah. Romaine.
Right. Cases of E. coli were discovered. Lettuce grown in Yuma, Arizona, and the Centers for Disease Control issued a warning about all romaine lettuce in the United States. We were tossing lettuce into the trash at my house. Did you see the overworked Twitter joke? It's the decline and fall, wait for it, of the romaine empire. Yes, yucksters include Emily Nussbaum of The New Yorker, Dan Zak of The Washington Post, and Peter Suderman. It's like a list of writers I really like.
I know.
It's like a list of journalism award
My
nominees.
Favorite thing about this segment is reminding me to check out the latest stories by these great writers.
Right. Dan Zak tweeted that. He must have written a good one also. And finally, I should say, news came last week that LeBron James bought 15 gray suits for his Cavs teammates, which they wore to Game 3 of their series against the Pacers. And then the Cavs lost Game 3.
Yeah.
After which a bunch of people tweeted stuff like, "I hope LeBron kept the receipt." But the best tweet came from basketball writer Rob Mahoney, who wrote, quote, "For sale, 15 suits, barely worn." Yeah. If you can make jokes using Very apocryphal good. Ernest Hemingway quotes, you got to do it.
Yep,
you
that's gotta so do good. It.
Thanks to David Mulhern for that one. All right, speaking of LeBron, David, let's talk about his interview with Ali LaForce after this brief commercial break.
Hey guys, this is Sean Fennessy, the editor-in-chief of The Ringer, and I want to tell you about a podcast I host called The Big Picture. Each week, I welcome a different filmmaker to talk about their latest movie and how it was made. I've talked to the directors of some of my favorite movies, including Jordan Peele, Greta Gerwig, Ryan Johnson, Barry Jenkins, and dozens more. You can find new episodes on the Channel 33 feed every Friday by going to theringer.com/podcasts or by subscribing to Channel 33 wherever you get your podcasts. I hope you'll check it out.
Our second topic, David, I'd like to call LaForce is with me. I am one with LaForce. LaForce is with me. I am one with LaForce. In game two of that aforementioned Cavs-Pacers series, LeBron James scored 46 points. But the question he was asked after the game wasn't, "LeBron, how big was that performance? Or what can you say about this team's heart?" It was this from Turner reporter Ali LaForce.
During this game, we got the really devastating news. The Spurs announced that Aaron, Coach Popovich's wife, officially passed away. I know you're close with Pop. Any words or thoughts you'd like to share with him?
Fans, we hope you enjoyed your evening here with us tonight. We look forward to seeing you right back here at the Q on Friday for the Game 2 Watch Party. It starts at 7 p.m. Stop by the ticket office.
I'm a huge Pop fan. I love Pop. That's such a tragedy, and you know, my best wishes goes out to Pop and his family. I know that's devastating news, and it's just a lot. I mean, the NBA family, we all stick together. I know we compete every night, but something like this happens, it puts everything in perspective. So,
and thus started one of the great sports media Twitter fights of 2018. We'll get into the circumstances in which the question was asked in just a second, but let me say this flatly, as if LaForce had just walked up to LeBron and asked him the question cold.
Yeah.
I'm okay with it.
Yes.
I'm not offended. I'm not offended at all. And what do we want sideline reporters to do, right? Do we want them to ask the toothless question that I like to make fun of on Twitter, or do we want them to ask interesting questions that might actually elicit news and or an interesting response? And if it's door number two, there are going to be moments that are a little bit awkward.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. Where did you fall on this?
I was sort of perplexed by the whole controversy. I mean, I understand it logically, but I didn't. I think I caught on right about the time that like Ernie Johnson was apologizing for it.
Right. He was going on to explain the context, but yes.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if I were going to take exception to it, it would just be like, you know, asking that question, asking about, you know, death in a post-game interview. But I don't disagree with the depth of the question, the surprise aspect, the you know, the potential controversy of it. Maybe I'm just too cynical, but it all seemed like a that's exactly what I would have expected her to ask, and it seemed, and I would not have expected anything. You know, I would have expected LeBron to be exactly as prepared for it as he was.
I saw a journalist on Twitter saying the question wasn't appropriate. And I guess I don't really care that much whether it was appropriate,
yeah.
Right? And for many of these journalists that were tweeting this, appropriate is like so far down their list of journalistic values, right? You know, they want to get news and hold the people accountable,
blah, blah, blah.
And then like appropriate is like number 39 on the list.
Yeah, and it's probably two tweets away from a thoroughly inappropriate tweet that they tweeted themselves.
Right. But I guess I'd rather her ask an interesting question than an appropriate question.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much. I mean, you know, you're not going to find me using phrases like outrage culture around this podcast or this office very
Thank
frequently.
God.
But there is certainly there's certainly a degree to which we on Twitter, especially, people get offended for other people.
Mm-hmm.
Like people will call things inappropriate. They'll call things offensive, but they won't point out who is actually offended by
right.
it.
And is it Greg Popovich by proxy?
Exactly.
Is it LeBron?
You're right. Someone has to be offended for something to be offensive, I think, sort of definitionally.
You need standing, like they say in court.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you're just like this, you can't do this. Like someone out there might be upset that I don't really get it.
Yeah. Why does LeBron, by the way, why does LeBron have to answer this? Why can't he say something like this is, you know, if she asked him, pops a question cold again. Going with this for the moment. Why can't he say it's awful news, but, you know, I'd like to call Pop and tell him what I feel before I,
sure.
you know, endeavor to say something on camera. Like,
I think that the only, if you want to talk about propriety in this situation, I think that it's that, I mean, you could make the case that LeBron or any athlete in his position, for them, that this is the most rote sort of robotic thing they do in the course of a day. Like playing basketball is a million times more, kind of spur of the moment than this.
Oh,
like this is just
improvisational.
Yeah,
yeah.
Improvisational. And so that's why it was more of a surprise to like go, because it's hard to get further out of left field, I guess, when you're used to saying like he was just like trying to figure out which of the four like this team just needs heart answers he was going to give. and then that question came. But I mean honestly it's like if more sideline reporters were asking questions like that, then we'd probably, like you said, it would be a more interesting enterprise altogether.
A friend of mine sent a note and said what he felt uncomfortable with was the fact that Aaron Popovich's death was being milked for content by the media, right? That everyone was trying to get a soundbite or a video clip that they could throw up on Twitter and, you know, kind of win Twitter for 5 minutes mm-hmm. with, right? And he's right, right? That is what journalists were doing, or lots of them, right? Here's Kevin Durant hearing the news from reporters at Warriors practice.
Pop spike passing.
Wait, what?
Literally, Kevin literally just found out 2 minutes ago. Yeah, they just put out a statement 2 minutes ago.
Seriously? Man. Prayers and condolences go out to his family. Damn. I don't know what to say, man.
And I guess I share the squeamishness at some level, but you know what? It's journalism, right? And let's say a reporter from the San Antonio Express News, right after that was announced, called up Tim Duncan, told him what had happened,
mm-hmm.
got Duncan's thoughts, and put them up online. How is that any different? Right? Other than Tim Duncan not being on camera. But how is that any different? How is that not just like a very basic function of journalism? I just don't really get it.
Yeah. No, I'm with you there.
And as it turns out, Allie LaForce didn't pop this question to LeBron, right? Uh-huh. As LeBron explains here.
This is where it gets good.
Yeah. In an uninterrupted video, she actually gave him a heads up and asked him if he'd like to say something.
That a question was asked to me post game, and a lot of people feel like I was blindsided. That is absolutely false. Allie LaForce told me that she was going to ask me the question and if it was okay. And once I started talking about it, once we were on air, actually my emotions just kind of took over. And that was just my emotions coming straight from my heart.
You know, it's funny. I think that this all speaks to something larger about sports television, which is we say when we watch these games that we want journalism, right? Mm-hmm. We want skepticism. We want hard-headed reporting. But I think what we really want is probably comfort. We want a nice, well-produced, not too upsetting experience. And anything that has any kind of awkwardness or, you know, any kind of rough patch, we just go, oh, ooh, I don't like that.
Yeah.
I don't like it. I just want to watch this game and enjoy it. I wouldn't want the athletes to be upset mm-hmm. or anything like that. I don't think we do want journalism out of those things.
Well, there's a small irony that this is that, you know, Greg Popovich is you know, involved in this story because he's the only thing that's made post-game interviews or, you know, sideline interviews worth discussing over the past several years.
Right. Those are content in and of themselves.
Yeah, and there's, you know, I don't think anybody cares that deeply about it, but you can certainly find, across the internet, there are many takes on whether Popovich is being disrespectful to the sideline reporters or whether he is, like, you know, sublimating the crowd. You know, if he's taking some brilliant meta, you know, take on the whole form.
Absolutely. Or both.
Yeah. We wish that the sideline reporters would ask more hard hitting questions. Ryan Russillo, a friend of the Ringer, was talking on his podcast, just last week about how people should just stop asking Pop basketball questions and just start asking him about politics, Donald Trump, school shootings, whatever. Just the thing of the day. Just make him answer those questions with hopes they could get an answer out of him.
Yeah.
Just jog him awake, sort of, you know?
Something interesting.
And I think, you know, there's probably something to that. If you don't want to talk, what's the point? If you're not going to say something, if you're not going to ask an interesting question and get an interesting answer, then that seems sort of meaningless to me.
Sure. Why not, right? I saw people tweeting about LaForce's producers. Essentially, they were saying, don't blame her, right? She's just, if you have a problem with this, mm-hmm. she's doing what her producers want them to do. And it's true that in the story of sideline reporters, producers are almost always the villain. Sure. I cannot tell you how many times when I've done stories about this, I'll go to a producer of a football game and they'll say, oh my gosh, so-and-so sideline reporter, she's as big a member of our team as anybody. And then they give her 3 minutes of a 3-hour broadcast.
Yeah.
Which is like saying, David, you are the most, you know, you are the most important employee at the Ringer. Please write one sentence a month yes. so we can publish it. I mean, we're just like your actions actually just indicate exactly the opposite.
Correct.
But I think in this case, and I understand you're trying to defend her by saying this, but I think you're blaming the producers as taking a certain agency away from her. Because to the extent I know about this world, if they said that and she did not want to do that
yeah.
and did not feel comfortable, she could just say into her talkback, I'm not going there right now.
Sure.
I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think this is appropriate.
Well, they're shielding her.
I think that would be fine.
Yeah, right? Well, they're shielding her just like an editor would, right? I mean, I'm not saying that Sean Fennessy would, you know, jump in front of a figurative bullet, but, you know, they would certainly protect you if something like, if this sort of controversy arose in something you wrote. But yeah, I mean, it's funny that the producers sort of are, you know, kind of writing to her defense.
It's more people on Twitter blaming the producers.
Oh, right.
It's like, don't blame LaForce, blame her producers.
Which sort of just seems unnecessary.
Yeah. Just to me, vaguely insulting if
yeah,
anything else.
I totally agree. I don't know. It was definitely weird, but I don't know why this is the moment of great, you know, outrage. I think that I feel like all of the content about this, about her passing leading up, I mean, before that was just as problematic if you're going to be offended by something.
Yeah, I feel this is like love of Greg Popovich.
Yeah.
Angst about sideline reporters.
Mm-hmm.
I have a Twitter account and want to tweet something.
Yeah.
Like all coming together into one weird ball.
Yeah.
That just doesn't seem really right at all. The
I think you were talking about the, you know, she's a very big part of the team, that whole sideline reporter thing. And I feel like that kind of reached its high point when Doris Burke was doing that, but still, you know, occasionally working games. And they and the network was forced to try to reconcile those two things. Doris Burke was a very big part of the program because there was a large, you know, course of people saying give her more to do. So they had to sort of, you know, explain that they care, you know, she had a very important role.
That's right.
And then they
compensated by actually giving her a very important role.
Yeah. Yeah, but the idea that she had an important role as a sideline reporter, I mean, there might have been a ton going on behind the scenes, but you're right. That's not a very important part of the show. And I think the more you defend it, the more that people are going to kind of call bullshit on it. And I think that that's probably part of this whole thing, too. It's the sideline reporters. It's the you know, feeling like the sideline reporters are trying to be portrayed as something more than unnecessary, which is we're comfortable. Like you said, we want comfort. We want the simplicity of sideline reporters asking benign, totally disposable basketball questions.
So we can see the guy who just scored 46 points.
Sweat, yeah, and potentially get like something dumped on him or whatever.
Sweat dripping off his forehead,
sure.
Smiling, right, talking about his good game.
Acting human, but not too human. Too human, being sad about someone passing is too human.
The great example, of course, of the uncomfortable sideline interview. Jim Gray, 1999 World Series, asking Pete Rose whether he's going to come clean about his gambling.
Yeah.
Which led the Yankees' Chad Curtis, weirdly, to boycott Gray after a World Series game.
Yeah.
Like, the team decided we're not talking to you. And again, that was another one, exactly what I'm talking about. Everybody who had ever written a column about Pete Rose had said all those things.
Sure.
But just saying it on television and saying it in that time and place made everybody freak out.
Yeah.
My favorite part of the story is Gray once told me that he was just in the middle of this media maelstrom. And he gets a letter from young Roger Goodell, who is navigating his way through the bureaucracy of the NFL, yet commissioner, saying, I thought you were absolutely right. I just like wanted to just send a letter of support. I didn't think you did anything wrong, which Goodell's office, in fact, confirmed to me that Roger had sent that letter. And I don't know if Roger was like, what appealed to him was the moral element of chastising Pete for gambling, or he does not strike me as somebody who likes hard-hitting journalism as a value. So I always found that totally fascinating. All right, David, finally, a segment about a brouhaha from the magazine world that I'd like to call Harper's Fury. That's a West Virginia reference, by the way, Harper's Ferry. David, when was the last time you thought about Harper's? And I don't mean thinking about it in a John Jeremiah Sullivan published a piece there in 2002 kind of way. I mean, as a vital magazine that's still publishing. Last week, editor James Marcus told the New York Times he'd been fired after he took a, quote, principled stand concerning a March essay the magazine ran that was critical of the Me Too movement. We'll talk about the essay in just a second, but has Harper's, like the New Republic magazine before it, entered the zone where the actual stories it publishes get less attention than whatever scandal is consuming the magazine?
Yes. I mean, frankly, the last time I thought, how long have I been in Los Angeles? 2 years almost?
Yeah, two and change, I think.
I mean, that's the last time I thought about Harper's.
Leaving New York was the moment you forgot about
the
Harper's.
The last time I saw a copy of Harper's on, you know, a coffee table at someone's apartment or, you know, in a publishing house waiting room, you know, I mean, that's honestly probably the last time I thought about it. I'm sure I've read Harper's, although I was going over.
Have you?
I'm sure I've read something from out of Harper's. I don't know. I mean, I say I'm sure because it's this sort of like it's as ingrained into me as part of the discourse. But I was looking through like, you know, scanning through like Longreads Best of 2017 to see if there was any Harper's content that I could, you know, mention for this story. And I couldn't, nothing just fell in my lap.
Yeah. I was looking at the TOC for the May issue.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Dyer.
Okay.
Rick Moody.
Yeah.
Rebecca Solnit. Jonathan D. Not bad.
Jonathan D's an old professor of mine. Great, great.
Not
man.
Bad.
Yeah.
Here's the tote board for the transactions column of Harper's. Lou Lapham, longtime editor and extremely purple writer,
mm-hmm.
ran the magazine for 28 years and left in 2006. Noted Texan Roger Hodge goes from 2006 to 2010. Then Ellen Rosenbusch from 2010 to 2015. Christopher Cox becomes editor and lasts all of 3 months in 2015.
Which is just... That's all you need to know about what's going on there.
Right. And then James Marcus from 2016 to 2018. I was struck by Marcus's comment that Harper's president Rick MacArthur is, quote, looking for a doormat at this point to edit the magazine. So what Jerry Jones is to Dallas Cowboys coaches, Rick MacArthur is to magazine editors. Is that about summing up?
Yeah, I think that makes it. I think that makes it. That's a pretty. That draws a pretty good parallel. Yeah.
The also when we talk about this particular controversy, what led to Marcus's ouster begins, and again, I'm quoting the Times here. Marcus tells the New York Times that MacArthur suggested the magazine, quote, run a contrarian piece on the Me Too movement.
Mm-hmm. We've all been in editorial meetings like this. Go ahead.
Always what you want to hear, right? Let's run a piece that will cover us all in shit.
Yeah.
Julia Malucci, who's the Harper's vice president of public relations, not an editorial role, reached out to Katie Roiffe. She's the one who reached out to Katie Roiffe.
Because she had a personal relationship with her, some point of connection.
Right, but she, the publicist, then, and she says, maybe think about the fact that the publicist had to assign stories because the editor didn't have ideas. I don't know. Maybe that's how bad it was. So this story gets assigned.
It's insane.
I know. Roiffe writes the story, or you know, it's not yet published, right? And then this whole thing starts out in journalism world, right?
Yeah.
Word circulates that she's going to out the creator of the shitty media men list in the piece. Moira Donegan, who was the creator, then outs herself in an essay in The Cut, preemptively. Roiffe insists that she wasn't going to out anyone. And then Nicole Cliff, who had a big Twitter thread about this week, which we can talk about, who wrote for the late website The Toast, started offering other writers who had pieces in Harper's money to pull their articles in protest.
Right, right, right.
Which is now where we are. That is a lot. And then the piece kind of comes out and is like barely mentioned, right? Like I actually read it for the first time when I was getting ready for this podcast.
Yeah. Well, it came out.
It came out, actually. All I remembered was the controversy about the story.
So if you want to talk about Harper's the institution, I mean, just sort of the place for these like grand old magazines in the modern era. I mean, there was a point where a magazine, even a bi-monthly magazine, was still just like a blog, right? I mean, I guess not a blog. It was the mid-length Ringer think piece of media back then. And then you had your, you know, there were weeklies that were the blogs, right, of that era. But the fact that it's not just the publication is so spread out, but that the machinery that undergirds it is still such a sort of dinosaur that it takes that. I mean, how long did it take between Donegan outing herself and the piece came out, what, 2 months later or something like that?
I think that's about right.
I mean, it's kind of crazy, right? And especially if you're going to stand by this piece and still publish this piece, the 2018 thing to do would be to put it up on the internet during the controversy.
Right. We believe in the story.
We believe in the story. And here's all the evidence you need that we're not outing anybody. This is just a slightly, you know, contrarian take.
But the presses were still running or something, right? I mean, it was triggered by a fact-checking query, right?
Which is just like, listen, I know a lot of wonderful fact-checkers. You know, I mean, you come across, if a magazine is employing fact-checkers to do this, kudos to them. Right, there are too many places that are running without a fact desk in 2018 and whatever. But I mean, what a failure to trigger that sort of response and not be able to contain it. It seemed like that Harper's response is a little bit unbelievable on that point.
Well, yeah,
right.
There was also this thing where Roiffe wasn't calling Donegan
right.
and saying, "Are you this person? I am reporting on this."
Mm-hmm.
It was a fact checker doing it on behalf of Roiffe. So
right.
it's just been outsourced to another person, which
right.
made the whole thing stranger.
Very, very odd.
To the point about the old schoolness of Harper's, Rick MacArthur in a 2014 feature in the Times.
Oh, yeah.
To correspond with literary friends like William Volman and Robert Caro, he sends notes that he composes on a typewriter. He also uses WordPerfect, or he did in 2014, because he feels, quote, Microsoft Word argues with him. He also saves his pieces to 3.5-inch floppy disks, which did not know you could really readily find anymore. He also called the internet. This was a notorious quote at the time. He called the internet. So the internet to him wasn't much more than a giant Xerox machine.
Yes.
And he said, if Harper's were trying to create an island, I hope, of economic and literary sanity, the world is coming back in the direction of paywalls and of print.
God.
So it wasn't just...
That's absolutely...
It wasn't just a magazine that's lumbering along like a magazine. It was purposefully, you know, ancient, right? whole idea of was, please go to this newsstand or, as you say, waiting room of a publishing house and read my magazine story. I think it's funny. I mean, to me, Harper's interesting. 15 years ago, there were like two entry-level jobs into magazines, or there were two frequently held ones, let's say this.
Yeah.
There was a Harper's internship and there was a New Republic internship.
Sure. Those are the two internships that you took in lieu of going to J school. The better than J school, take that
exactly,
internship.
Exactly. Because unlike J school, it pays like a couple $100 or something like that. The Harper's camp, you had our old pals, Tommy Craggs and Rafe Bartholomew. The New Republic camp, you have Stephen Roderick.
Mm-hmm.
Just about every known white male political writer.
Yeah.
And me.
And you.
And the cultural difference was amazing. Because I couldn't have been a Harper's intern, not to forget being qualified or whatever, which I certainly was not into for anything. But I couldn't have been it because I'm too dorky, right?
Mm-hmm.
The New Republic camp was just a lot like dorkier and, you know, more stiff.
Sure.
Right?
Stiff is a good word.
Harper's camp just feels cooler. You know, that just
especially from where you're sitting. I'm sure the people in the Harper's desk would probably disagree, but.
Yeah, but Harper's felt like it didn't need a nut graph, you know, like, right?
Oh, no.
It wasn't like, you know, the contrarian Olympics.
I mean, you could be walking the door at Harper's and you're like collecting art for the front of the magazine, like literal art, you know?
I don't remember that job existing in the New Republic. Yeah. I was there. Literal art. But the amazing thing, too, and both these magazines had this in common, is the magazines themselves have slipped. Meanwhile, their alumni network is running the world running big chunks of the media world, right? On the masthead of the New York Times Magazine, you have Harper's alums Jake Silverstein and Bill Wasik. Clara Jeffrey, who edits Mother Jones, Craggs, Rand Deadspin and Gawker, Christian Lorenzen, who is the book critic at New York Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
But Harper's people everywhere.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the tip of the iceberg, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, and that's just a very, very, very short list.
Yeah, no, it's sort of crazy. I mean, you saw this when the New Republic was sold. I'm not sure if it's been sold
which
since.
Time, yeah.
Yeah, but when there were like a lot of the alumni of the New Republic sort of came out of the woodwork to just decry the direction it had taken and, you know, what.
Right. It was somebody who was a contributing editor who just like, wait, did that guy to write for the
right.
Magazine?
But it's this sort of like this giant world of people who were like weaned there, who went on to bigger and better things, who are now, who feel territorial about the New Republic.
Yes.
And I'm sure the same is true for Harper's, but it's sort of like, you know, no one's. Like, you're not trying to stick around and keep this place afloat. You're not going to use your newfound celebrity to change the modern perception of it, right? Outside of a tweet or two.
You don't currently want to write for Harper's.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we need to like codify a rule of journalism here. This is not perfect, all right? But Curtis's law of magazines would say something like this, right? The smaller the circulation and the bigger the gap between your former and current level of prestige, okay?
Uh-huh.
The bigger and more insane the controversies your magazine will produce.
Sure.
I mean, this is also the New Republic, right? This is hard, but like you will just then have these crazy controversies. Like this isn't happening at the New Yorker right now, right? Esquire, you know, got rid of their editor and a bunch of people quit, but this comparable thing is not happening there, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is happening at Harper's.
Yeah, I mean, I think if MacArthur wants to, you know, stay as far away from the internet as possible, I mean, I guess it's too bad for him because he's just like, you know, welcomed himself into the internet in the worst possible way with this sort of ridiculous controversy. The only time that people are going to have talked about Harper's in years is you know, blog posts about him firing his editors all the time for crazy stuff.
Totally.
How long was Chris Cox there? 3 months?
3 months.
I mean, would you take a job where the previous editor in chief had only lasted 3 months without some just catastrophe being attached to it?
Yeah, and I believe what his alleged violation was that he wanted to redesign the cover of the magazine, and MacArthur said no. That's what it was reported as. Also, this one, I forgot about this one. After firing Roger Hodge in 2010, John Coblin reported that a staff member was listening at the door of MacArthur's office while MacArthur was giving an interview to the New York Times about the firing and produced a picture in the New York Observer of this staff member going like this.
Uh-huh.
I mean, just imagine if something like that happened at ESPN. Jim Miller would have already written like 4 oral histories about it. I mean, that'd be the most incredible thing in the world. Somebody's listening in John Skipper's office while he's giving an interview. And it's just, that is utterly incredible to me. But
that
it happened. And it was so incredible, we just forgotten about it.
God. Wait, I know we've already been through the stories about Hodge's, you know, lack of or old-fashionedness, but you just
please keep going.
You mentioned Hodge and I just pulled up this note. that said a couple months after his firing, so presumably contemporaneous with that story, a senior editor helped convene a meeting about publishing Harper's on the iPad. MacArthur did not attend, but shortly thereafter, staffers began receiving Xeroxed articles from MacArthur in their mailboxes that trashed the iPad and Kindle.
Which weirdly connects back to his idea of the internet as a giant Xerox machine.
Yeah,
right?
And then when somebody from the Times said that the Atlantic was profitable in that year because of their heavy investment on the web, his response was, quote, "They're lying. They're a private company and they can say whatever they want."
Okay.
Okay, that's fair. I mean, it's fair that someone in that, you know, a decade ago would have thought that the web would never be profitable, at least not in the you know, structure in which money was being made at that point in time. There was some crazy stuff going on. I mean, you know, sort of paywalls and, I mean, this was the beginning of the paywall era, and that's all just sort of, it's maybe unfair. We've talked about this with when we talked about Condé Nast not that long ago. It's maybe unfair to compare Harper's to The Ringer, or I mean, obviously there's big content differences, but to compare, you know, Harper's to something that is relatively new, that was born in the internet era. But, you know, it's not that hard to compare Harper's to Lapham's Quarterly, which is what Lewis Lapham did when he walked out the door, and they have a great internet presence. You know, they find a way to manage to be current and not be, you know, and to be vital, but presumably they're making money, even if, I don't know if they're operating as a nonprofit or what. It doesn't matter. They're doing fine.
Yeah. I mean, what a strange thing to, like, not doing as well as Lapham's Quarterly, the strange measure of media success.
But that's the thing, is I don't feel like Lapham's Quarterly aspires to quite as much, you know, they don't have quite as much starch into their shirts, you know? And I just, it feels like that, you know, if you can be that, you can be what Harper's was, you can do it the way that, you know, N+1 is doing it, but it's with a little bit of a wink. You know, they're very self-serious over there too, but they still feel self-aware and modern.
Right.
And I don't know. It's all just so crazy.
We don't need to do a classic Michael Kinsley story every week. But this one's particularly relevant since he was turned out of the Harper's editor job for Lewis Lapham. I don't know how long he was polishing this line, but the Washington Post called him about doing a profile of Lapham and Lapham's Quarterly, as you mentioned, right? And this is what he said. He called Lapham a very mysterious character. One of the mysteries is, what the hell is he saying when he's writing? I sometimes feel like I'm in a reading comprehension test, and I'll turn the page and there will be questions like, what is the theme of this passage? One of the great low-key magazine burns of all time. All right. That's the press box for this week. Thanks to our fearless producer, Jim Cunningham, and contributor to Overword Twitter joke, Jim Cunningham, David Shoemaker. See you next week for more hot takes about our media universe.
I've got another hour on Harper's, but we'll let it go.
That'll be a bonus pod. All right. See you, buddy. Eyes, Chuck Todd.
Yeah.
Intercom is the business messaging platform that does the manual work for you, automatically qualifying leads and scheduling demos. Their chatbot and messenger free you up to focus on the prospects most likely to convert. You can leave your pipeline to chance, or you can use Intercom. Start for free at intercom.com/growth. That's intercom.com/growth.